Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we're taking your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question at zestygarden@gmail.com, or also post a comment to the UPR Facebook page. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here.
Well, I returned from Northern California, and it's interesting to see what's growing there. I do appreciate our drier weather, our usually a little bit warmer weather because I was on the coast. But I miss having that extension of their growing season that they do get.
Yeah, you know, and we're growing here in the valley. Today that's got a little bit of rain and the temperature's quite a bit cooler.
It feels good.
It's a nice change. I mean, I'm not complaining. I walked over and I thought, oh, I'll grab my umbrella. And then I said, oh, heck, I'm going to let it rain on me because it actually feels so nice. And we just have to understand that the kind of climate that we live in means that there's going to be long periods during each year when we're probably going to be woefully short on natural precipitation, and so we're going to have to apply it artificially through our irrigation systems, and then you get this cooler time of the year where the moisture starts coming in, and yet at the same time we've got stuff in our garden that doesn't allow us to continue really getting produce out of it. So we need to be thinking about how we preserve our garden for extended lengths of time. And in the past, we've talked about high tunnels and row covers and low tunnels and any structure that we can, put in there to help us, get more out of it and actually help things go for a longer period of time, because the first frost will come shortly, and then after that we'll have a nice stretch of weather. And, if you can save your tomatoes or save your peppers or so, I mean, you can still have plenty of that product coming off for, another 6 weeks. But if we don't protect those plants, then they're done for the year, and then we have to suffer eating the lousy stuff that we get in our grocery stores.
Well, let me ask you, what are the advantages to growing in our climate versus being on the coast? I mean, the temperatures that we have today, that's basically what they get most of the summer. It doesn't get much above 80 degrees. I was in the Arcata, basically Humboldt County area of Northern California. And
yeah, if you look at temperatures and kind of think about those things, we can kind of classify our vegetables into two categories, those that like those cooler conditions and those that like our warmer type of conditions. And it is something that changes what we maybe grow and when we grow them. Part of the problem that we have in our local environment is that deal with issues of hot type conditions, and we need to want to be growing cool type crops, and at other times of the year we really want to grow cool type crops, and yet it might be too cool or for those types of things as well. And so one of the things that California has and why it has such a diverse range of crops is that what we tend to see is that under those right conditions, they can grow crops for a really, really long period of time and meet those leafy green requirements, which all fall into our cool weather category. And we have such a short spring, and then we move into this really hot type conditions that those plants don't do very well. And then now we're moving into the cool type conditions when you think you can start growing them again, but then it gets so cold that they don't want to grow. And so, our production window is compressed so much by the environment that we live in and the elevation that we're at we have to strategize new ways of growing these things.
So can a place that's only getting up to 80 degrees during the summer, can they grow things like cantaloupe and watermelon and the more warm season vegetables?
They can. It kind of just depends on how cold it gets at night, because we know that when temperatures drop into the mid-50s, the low 50s, that's when some of these warm weather crops succumb to a disorder that we call chilling injury. So the plant is actually designed to function best between like 60 and 85, those warm weather crops. And our cool weather crops are designed to function best between about 45 and maybe 70. That range of temperatures is critical. And so if our mean temperature during much of the year is in that, you know, 45 to 70 degree range, then cool weather crops do really well. And that's why Salinas, California and coastal California grows so many leafy vegetables, because they like those kind of conditions. Why do they grow most of the melons and most of the tomatoes in the Central Valley? Well, because the day temperatures are quite a bit warmer than that, and they're more in that 65 to 85 or 90 degree range on average day, night. And therefore, they're more suitable to the warm weather crops. And so when we think about our own environments here in the state of Utah, regardless of where you live, if you're in one of the higher mountain valleys, the Heber Valley or someplace like that, you know, it's quite a bit cooler during the day and it's quite a bit colder at night. And so those are good places to grow some of these leafy vegetables. Yet because of their mountain elevation, the production window tends to be really, really short. And once it does get really hot, you know, some of these plants just shut down under those conditions. And so using structures like high tunnels, low tunnels, floating row covers can all give us an option for pushing the production season at the front end a little bit earlier and at the back end a little bit later, and thereby allow us to grow a more diverse range of vegetable crops. Can we grow them? Sure. Do we get a lot of production out of them? Not so much, because the season, the length of the season from start to end tends to be kind of the restrictor of how much you're going to get.
Well, let's talk about some of those ways to extend the growing season. So you've got your vegetables in, you've been harvesting, but would like to have it continue. What do you need to do?
Well, like at this time of the year, you know, you may have done some seeding of, you know, reseeding of things like radishes and maybe some fall lettuce and some spinach, crops that grow reasonably fast and really kind of like the kind of temperatures we've been having for the last few days, where it isn't getting too warm during the day and it's cooling off enough at night. And so if you look at the mean between those, it's about in their ideal range. And so they do very, very well. But as our night temperatures get colder, they're going to be impacted by that as well. And so we want to use these structures to try and keep that temperature up a little bit more. And so some of the structures that we can put over top of those types of plants are things like a floating row cover, and that then traps air around the plant. And particularly it's of value at night when the night temperatures are dropping too much. If our day temperatures aren't getting high enough, that's when we might put a small low tunnel over top of them, just some wire and some plastic over top of that wire, and create a tube that has plants growing underneath it. And that then allows more radiant energy from the sun to get trapped during the day and give those plants the appropriate mean temperature so that they continue to grow. And they should be you should start thinking about putting those on in northern Utah, you know, toward middle to end of September. And you have to kind of watch your weather for that, because we can still get some warm weather, and you don't want to cook them underneath there. And you can do that with these structures. And then into October, of course, and maybe even into November, if you have those in play, you know, you can still be harvesting things like radishes and lettuce and spinach and chard and mustards and arugulas. And, you know, you can kind of see where we're going with this. All of those things are things that I like to put in my salads, and there's no point in buying those. Why not grow those? Because the climate and is conducive to them, provided we give it a little help.
So when we're giving it a little help, do we also help the insects along? Or typically in the fall, do those populations begin to die off and we're able to garden
free of those? The insects are opportunistic as well as anything. They respond to temperature, and some of them have distinct life cycles that by the fall of the year, they're looking for places to hide. And they cue in not only on temperature, but also on light levels and photo period and things like that. And so, yeah, we can, you know, generally see fewer insects, but if you create an environment that's favorable for them, like your low tunnel or like a high tunnel, you know, we see that we'll still have aphid problems even into November and December, and we see aphids in January, and because the environment is conducive for those insects to multiply and grow because the temperatures are better, just like our plants are responding to it. So there's a certain degree of, yeah, we're not going to do away with problems that we've seen. It's just that we have to understand that, you know, we're creating a nice environment for our plants, and those environments are also equally nice for our insects, and we just need to pay attention to them, and you know, we can manage them just as easy as we can at other times of the year.
So in a higher mountain valley like in Heber or with Logan, realistically using floating row covers or plastics to make smaller tunnels, how long can we expect to continue to grow things like leafy greens?
We've done a little bit of work in our high tunnels with them, and I have a project with my students, and we'll plant in our high tunnel. We're going to transplant into the high tunnel around the 1st of October, and we basically then will have lettuce and, you know, we're growing Chinese cabbage in them, and we've done spinach in the past, and we've done arugula, and you name it. We do it all with our students, different things. But this year we're just growing pak choi and lettuce. Well, we'll have plants that are actively growing and putting on weight and size until the project is finished, which is just the week before Thanksgiving. And then we always kind of fill the whole tunnel, and the students harvest out the plants that they need for their project, and then we just throw floating row cover over top of the plants in there, and I usually have extra plants that we can harvest right up until Christmas time.
Hmm.
And so by then we've cleaned the plants, the project up, and things like that, and so there's no reason why you couldn't in at Thanksgiving transplant lettuce and spinach and a few of the other hardy ones, kales, some of the Chinese cabbages, some of the mustards and those types of things in the tunnel, again in late November, cover them with floating row cover to add a layer of extra protection within that tunnel, and then start reharvesting again by late January. And depending on how big you want the plants to be, you could start harvesting before then. Now, normally at that late season, we don't usually recommend that you sow seeds in the soil. And the reason we don't recommend sowing seeds in late November, December, and January is that the soil temperatures, even in our tunnels, are quite cold. And it's actually too cold for the plants to germinate. So the best thing to do is to transplant at those dates, and yet the plants establish quite nicely and will grow very, very well over the course of the winter. And certainly then, you know, they really pick up steam come February when the light levels start to increase and the temperatures start to warm up a little bit too. That's when they really start to go. So we've effectively now, with certain commodities, been able to grow plants here in Logan anyway all winter long, so to speak.
So are there particular varieties of leafy greens that do better than others? The whole idea is keeping the root systems alive, I'm assuming the tops during the hard time of the winter will die back.
No, they don't really die back.
They
may slow up in their growth, but you know, in our measurements we tend to harvest the plants, we'll count the number of leaves, we'll do all of those kinds of things, and we find that the plants are continually growing new leaves. They're just not growing them as fast because the leaf temperature is a little bit on the cold side, so that they don't both put on too much numbers of leaves, but they don't also expand nearly as fast. And so they're kind of growing really, really slowly because overall the amount of light the plant receives and the temperature that they receive is just a little less than optimal for them. And so the idea of a secondary cover, or in some cases, some farmers, I have met a few farmers now that are, you know, heating the soil. They're using either electric heating cables in the soil underneath those beds to warm them up to make the plants grow faster, or they're, you know, putting a hot water heater in their tunnels and getting the temperature on that hot water to a certain level, and then putting piping out through the soil to and circulating that around in order to actually add just a little bit of warmth, because the light levels are adequate. It's really the temperature that's slowing up the development. So by artificially adding in a small amount, they can actually continue to supply the markets that they're working on. And you know, the same type of thing could go in a home garden. And these heating cables are relatively inexpensive. The amount of energy that they require in terms of electricity isn't great. And what it will allow you to do is, in segments of it, in conjunction with either a low tunnel inside your high tunnel or a floating row cover, just that helps trap some of that heat that's coming up from the soil around the plants to create a warmer environment so that the plants grow faster.
So when you said put in a water heater, what kind of water heater is this? Because this sounds like pretty serious home gardening.
Well, it is, and it's probably not something that a home gardener will work on, but a commercial farmer who says, I've got, you know, a large high tunnel and I've got a market for my lettuce in my area, and I can calculate the cost of the production of that. I can kind of begin to work toward figuring out how much productivity I need every week for my market, and I know kind of what my input costs are. As a small additional input cost, which is, you know, an electric hot water heater or a propane-based hot water heater, and I don't need a tremendous amount of heat from that, and it's a closed loop, so it's just cycling water through this, and so it doesn't really cool off that much as it gets pumped through the house, you can effectively increase your productivity. Well, we've done it with our electric heat cables by, you know, 50 to 100%. So without any heat, we would grow X, we would grow 2X or more productivity with a little extra heat. And when we sit down and calculate what that cost is, it's not very bit much. And so on the scale of a commercial farmer, that may make sense. Now, for our home audience, that may not make sense to do those types of things. But, you know, the volume of product that you need out of it is probably a whole lot less for your home use.
And it's fun to experiment.
But it's fun to experiment too, yeah. And it's not outside the realm of possibilities, even for the home garden. And more people are finding that, you know, I know what my food source is, and I, you know, I'm comfortable with what I do in terms of my production. Plus, you know, it's just, you know, kind of you get outside and you get to do something, and on a bright sunny day in the middle of the winter inside your high tunnel, it's actually quite a pleasant place to be. Because it is fairly warm and the sun is shining on you, and you got plants that are green all around you, and, you know, read a book or do something, and it certainly is possible in the home garden. And plus, you can grow what you like. Now, can you grow tomatoes? Probably not. Can you grow peppers and other warm weather crops? Probably not. But you certainly can have kale and leafy greens and you know, most of the cool weather crops, you know.
So could you put things in like beets?
You could,
or
yes.
Carrots?
Absolutely.
Have some baby carrots.
You know, you start sowing them, you know, in early September, so the crop comes up and gets established, and it has a fairly long time to grow. You'll get some of those throughout the whole winter, or you know, basically build your tunnel over stuff that you have out in the garden so that it can continue to go. And when it gets too cold, you know, the tomatoes that you have in there no longer are producing anything, but that just opens up space for something else. So you can, you know, replant spinach and lettuce and all of these other crops that don't mind the cold weather.
In your experience, have you seen certain crops do better than others as far as being raised in these higher these high tunnels?
Well, any crop will do well. Some of them just don't logically make sense, because I had someone, well, I actually saw it in Logan here. They were growing sweet corn in their high tunnel. And if you sit back and think about how long it's in there and what your level of productivity is relative to other types of crops, sweet corn probably isn't a very good option for them. But obviously that person likes sweet corn, so for them, it might have been an okay option. Do you grow melons in those crops? You know, you can, but then there's some other issues. You know, you have to get those melons pollinated, and if you don't have a way to pollinate them or don't know how to hand pollinate them, then that might not be a good option for you. But things like tomatoes and peppers and eggplant and tomatillos and beans and some squashes, you know, you can start them really, really early and have them go really, really late in the year. So the earliest we've had things like that are, we started harvesting our beans in the last week of May this year, snap beans, and we could have just kept planting beans so that we would have beans all the way up to Thanksgiving. We've grown tomatoes up to Thanksgiving, peppers up to Thanksgiving. So there's ways that you can, you know, really change, you know, what normally we see in our garden is tomatoes in mid to late August all the way through till sometime when the frost comes. Now we can have tomatoes from the 1st of July until November. Late November, really. And, you know, that's quite a bit larger window of stuff that you've grown on your own and enjoy, because it tastes so much better than what we are getting in our grocery stores.
Can you wear out a plant? In other words, if I've got a zucchini and I'm wanting to see how long I can get this thing to grow, is it just naturally going to back off on its production, even if I had the temperatures up?
It does. You know, one of the problems we see with zucchini and things like that is about this time of the year, we start getting quite a bit of powdery mildew that shows up. And that is an organism that's floating all over, you know, so it's a ubiquitous type of disease. But it's favored by cooler, moister conditions, which we often start to see. You know, the nights are starting to cool down and the humidity starts to raise, and so the powdery mildew starts to show up. And if you drive around and look at people's gardens or you look at commercial pumpkin fields, you know, you'll see a tremendous amount of powdery mildew at this time of the year. And so that tends to be the organism that kind of wipes out the production. But if you can control that organism, you can have the crop. Now, can you grow a zucchini from, you know, late May all the way till November? It's kind of hard to do that. The plants kind of grow and they're very productive, and then they kind of just get old and they get tired and they don't perform. So
sounds like a chicken.
Yeah. So if you don't
laying eggs,
right? So if you don't kind of think about that aspect, then you're not going to have the production. But there's nothing to say that you can't start another zucchini plant, your May plant, and then you might have a July plant, and then you may have a late August plant. And what you've done then is those younger plants tend to be more vigorous. They tend to be a little bit more disease tolerant, and they tend to be most productive at the younger stage than rather as they when they age. And so just by kind of pre-thinking your needs, why plant six zucchinis in May? You know, you have them all in early August and, you know, you're kind of overwhelmed. Plant two in May and two in July and two in August, and you effectively got the same type of production. You just have it in a more manageable way and you could do that with just about any crop. Now, tomatoes, we've got different types of tomatoes, those that are determinate types. They are very compact in their production and they put all their fruit load and their productivity out at a very short time frame. Or you have the indeterminate types that just keep flowering. So, you know, some of the cherry tomatoes are that way. My cherry tomato at home is like 6 or 7 feet tall, and it's got blooms all over the place, and it's just gone wild. And that's an indeterminate type. And yet, you know, we were looking at it, and there's just like so much fruit on it that's green right now. But, you know, as soon as it freezes, it's going to be gone. And it's not really in a place that I can protect it. So, you know, it's what it is. But in a tunnel, I could, you know, have all of those fruits in October yet, and until it gets to the point where, you know, I'm tired of it, or it's so cold at night that the plant can't tolerate it anymore.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is in studio. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 1-800-826-1495. That's good anywhere you can listen to us over the air. 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us your email question. The address is zestygarden@gmail.com. Or if you prefer, you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comments there. We're going to be taking just a slight break. We'll be back in just a moment with more with Dan Drost. Right now, we're going to hear a segment from Nancy Williams. She is a local journalist and works at Utah State University. And a good friend of mine, and also a good friend of the person she's going to talk about, Will Pitkin. Will Pitkin was a gardener extraordinaire, passed away in July. He taught English at Utah State University, but is well known for sharing of his crops in his Hyde Park garden.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams with Petals and Prose. Utah Public Radio lost a dear friend this summer when Will Pitkin died. Will was many things, among them a retired professor of English, a pillar of the Cache Valley Gardener's Market, consummate backyard vegetable gardener who was justly famous for his tomatoes and garlic, a dedicated chicken farmer, and an addicted Scrabble player who more often than not beat the pants off his partners, including me. Many people have shared memories and stories about Will. His Facebook page is overflowing with funny tales and tributes, and hundreds of his friends showed up at a celebration of life held August 25th in Bill and Carol Strong's shady green backyard on the Logan River. If you can judge a man by the quality of the people who turn out to tell him goodbye, then you were a pretty great person, Will, wrote his friend Charles Cuthbertson about the farewell party. His friend Dan Bam said Will was a gentle, kind soul, at home in the classroom teaching at USU and in the garden with his chickens and garlic. Even if we only knew him a short while, he had a profound influence on Alicia and me. His friend Becky Stauffer wrote, "I won't be able to attend the memorial for Will, but I found this poem he sent me a few years ago when we had been chatting about the solstice during a Scrabble game. I thought Will's friends and family might enjoy this. I agree. This poem contains very much essence of Will. Here are his words. Winter solstice. More than 2 hours ago, I opened the door to the hen house and spread across the space I'd cleared of snow yesterday's lettuce from Lee's Market and yesterday's bread soaked in hot water from Crumb Brothers Bakery. Now along the mountain ridge, the southmost sun edges above the solstice notch, and framed by the radiant icicles barring my kitchen window, the hens now peck in sunlight at the frozen leaves and scratch the scattered loaves, no longer steaming. 2 below 0, the reading says. The hens move about on bare feet, surely miserable. One in molt must certainly have thoughts of doom, fluff showing that should be hidden, trapping warmth and layered over with full feathers. She stands on 1 foot, the other drawn beneath her ragged wing. She has no thoughts of doom, of anything. I worry for her. She does not worry for herself. I know that she, that they, are miserable. She, they, do not. We tell stories, make movies about elephants and penguins and fish, and their moments of joy, of abject terror, of hope, of hopeless misery. Elephants and penguins and fish do not tell these stories, nor understand them, however slowly we spin them out. As I mumble my solace, my miserable hens stand mindless on frozen ground, pecking their food, mindless that tomorrow will have minutes more sunlight. Mindless of tomorrow, or that July will offer misery of its own. Only a few thousand years ago, on this very day, no calendar had yet named, a family, a tribe huddled for warmth, awaiting the southmost sunrise. When the curved edge appears, a thin beam of harvested sunlight strikes a rock face, exactly where they have dreamed, have prayed it would. A murmur of relief, cause enough for cautious hope. What they witness this day brings comfort. They will know more tomorrow. Will's son, Joe Pitkin, wrote one of the world's greatest obituaries for his father. Would that we all could live so that our children would write such a wonderful farewell for us. It's worth sharing, and I want to end today by reading it to you. Willis Lloyd Pitkin, Jr., the son of Willis L. and Dorothy Schuler Pitkin, died July 21, 2013. He did not expect to meet Heavenly Father, but if such a meeting occurred, Willis was likely the less flabbergasted of the two. Will was born February 20, 1936, and lived until 1969 in California. He was married three times, to Mary Frederica Callaghan, who gave him a stepdaughter, Regan, and two sons, David and Paul, to Sandra Sanderson, who gave him a son, Joe, and two daughters, Sarah and Clarity, and to Terry Haynes Buschetti, who gave him four stepsons, Rock, Brian, Tim, and Russ. Thorough and conscientious training from his first two wives prepared him for a wonderful third marriage. He lived to mourn the loss of Brian, Dave, and Regan's first daughter, Mary Helen. Will received his bachelor's degree in English from the University of Southern California in 1958, promptly began graduate school, and received his doctorate from the same university in 1973. When he finally applied for graduation, the dean of the USC Graduate School emerged from his office to congratulate Will as the student who had made the slowest progress towards a doctorate that he had ever encountered. During his graduate studies and for many years afterward, Will worked as a teacher of college English, most of these years, and the best of them, at Utah State University. He helped and inspired and loved thousands of students who remember him for his wit, his generosity, his deep knowledge, and his disdain for academic fashions. He was likelier to wear a t-shirt and shorts to class than a coat and tie. He preferred always to be called Will rather than Dr. Pitkin. He wrote a textbook on writing called Generating Prose, a book considered unfashionable almost as soon as he'd finished it, but it was no less a good book for that. Like his father, Will was a lifelong gardener. He kept many dozens of chickens, cultivated hundreds of heirloom varieties of tomatoes and squash and garlic and strawberries, spared thousands of tomato hornworms. Over his life, he gave away great piles of fruit and vegetables to friends, colleagues, his children, neighbors, strangers, visiting home teachers, and anyone who looked like he would be cheered up by a handful of fresh tomatoes. Also like his father, he was deeply troubled by any kind of waste. It pained him to see people treat as garbage anything which could be spread on his garden as fertilizer. In broad daylight, and sometimes by night, Will took the grass clippings that neighbors had left at the curb for garbage pickup. The whole community had contributed to his compost heap. It was harder still for him to watch someone throw into the trash anything which might be eaten by one of his beloved animals, including his most beloved animal, Homo sapiens. He regarded the expiration dates on food packaging as quaint advisories which he might, at his discretion, disregard. He spoke slowly but tirelessly. He wrote hundreds of letters to the editor of the Herald Journal. At least it seemed that many. Letters shining a light wherever he saw thoughtlessness or hypocrisy or self-righteousness. Nonconformists, gay people, misfits, and anyone who felt friendless in the Cache Valley knew from his letters that they had a friend in Will. Years of linguistic training and a natural talent for goofing off made him into a formidable Scrabble player. He impressed hundreds of opponents with his ability to make one word into another, to dredge up long-forgotten words, and to concoct plausible-sounding terms that no one at the table dared challenge. Language was, for him, a source of joy and mystery and beauty, and people who spoke with him or read a note from him or played a game with him came away feeling as though language was richer than they had realized. He is at peace now, survived by his wife Terry, daughters Regan Pitkin Butler, Sarah Sanderson Pitkin, and Clarity Sanderson Jonker, sons Paul, Joe, Rock, Tim, and Russ, 15 grandchildren and one great-grandson. We miss him. As Terry said, "Thanks for being best friends to my good husband for all these years. Won't we miss him?" Yes. Oh, yes. So very much. I'm Nancy Williams with Petals and Prose. Until next time.
Programming on Utah Public Radio was made possible in part by our members and Green Valley Spa and Resort in St. George, featuring a Saturday reading retreat September 14th and 21st, helping individuals build a rhythm of reading practice into their lives. Details at greenvalleyspa.com.
You know, I was just sitting here thinking how much Will did for the community, and I have this gigantic aloe vera plant in my living room that actually blossomed last year because it was one of the last things that Will did for me before he moved away from the area. He called me up and says, "Brian, I've got something for you." And whenever he said that, I'd run up to his house because he just lived about three blocks away, and I knew something was going to be good. And cool. So I've got this aloe vera plant that's probably, I don't know, 3 feet in diameter and just gigantic. And I've had rosemary and strawberries, and I've got three things growing from him in my yard right now.
Will was a great guy, and he is sorely missed.
We will miss you, Will. Well, I have a gardening calendar and a couple of items of things coming up. The Utah Botanical Center in Kaysville is hosting a diagnostic clinic on Wednesday, September 18th at 3 p.m. If you have any problems with trees and shrubs, lawns, vegetables, or flower gardens, their master gardeners can help. Details are at utahbotanicalcenter.org. Thanksgiving Point in Lehigh is hosting a workshop on what's bugging your plants. It's Tuesday, September 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. This class will help you better understand what to look for and how to treat common pests and diseases in the landscape or your vegetable garden. To register, go online at thanksgivingpoint.com. And then the Wasatch Community Gardens in Salt Lake is hosting their community garden cruise Saturday, September 28th from 10 to 1. The cruise is an opportunity to tour diverse community gardens in the Wasatch Community Gardens network. Participants will meet garden organizers and be inspired by unique community agriculture projects across Salt Lake County. Details are online at wasatchgardens.org. And then, of course, there are gardeners markets all throughout the state. The Wayne County Farmers Market in Torrey is held each Saturday from 4 to 6:30 p.m. at 185 West Main Street and runs through October. Ogden's historic downtown farmers and art market takes place Saturdays from 8 to 1 at 25th Street and Grant Avenue. And then the Cache County Gardeners Market, the Cache Valley Gardeners Market, is held this year at Willow Park. And that's usually from 9 until 1 p.m. And, okay, I'm going to put a plug in here. On the 28th, a men's group that I sing in is going to be singing at the Gardener's Market. So,
okay.
Shameful plug there.
Yes.
Well, okay, so we have Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, in studio for the rest of the hour. And if you'd like to get in a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Email us your question, zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your comment there. Now, Dan, before we went to the break, you had mentioned something about about ripening, and so I started thinking about tomatoes. And that's probably one of the most frequent questions that I hear about or get from people is, I can't get my tomatoes to turn red.
Well, there's a couple things that I think people run into when they have tomatoes that aren't ripening. You might have a lot of them on the plant, and depending on the time of the year, getting them to start to color has a lot to do with how well you've managed those plants. And oftentimes, tomatoes tend to do better with a little bit of neglect and a little bit of abuse.
Throughout the year?
Throughout the year, yeah. And the neglect and abuse tends to put a little stress on the plant. And when the plants are stressed, they produce a compound called ethylene. And as a result, that compound is the ripening hormone that the plants produce, and that helps color them up and get them to ripen. But if they've been coddled and pampered, they really feel no need to move along and get the thing started because things are good. And so then those types of plants tend not to ripen very quickly.
So this is the same compound that's in apples and bananas.
Exactly.
To ripen all your pears at the same time.
That's right. And so, you know, stressing plants can help. So if you have tomatoes at this time of the year that have a lot of fruit on them and, you know, you've gotten some ripe ones, generally what happens is as you start the ripening process on the plants, those fruits that are coloring tend to produce a lot of ethylene, and so that tends to migrates around in the plant, and it really starts to kick things off.
I was just thinking, should I take a bunch of bananas and sit it on top of my cages?
Well, yeah, that might work, but it's not the best. Commercially, what some of the commercial farmers do is they actually apply a precursor of that element to the plants to get them to do what they want them to do. And that kind of uniformly ripens them for whatever they're doing. So they may do that. Now, as temperatures get colder, ethylene doesn't respond as much. So at this time of the year, they don't ripen nearly as well because our day temperatures are not as warm and our night temperatures are quite cool. And so as we move into late September, then the ripening process actually slows up even more. So it's a temperature-dependent type of response. So what can you do to get them to go? Put a little stress on them. And the types of stresses are just turn your irrigation off to your tomatoes right now because they aren't going to last that much longer. And if they're under some stress by water, they're going to ripen those fruit quite rapidly. The other thing you can do is go take a shovel and on one side of the plant, about 6 inches away from it, straight down, just cut most of the roots off on that one side, and that will put some drought stress on them, just like cutting the water off to them will do it. And that also forces them to start to ripen those fruits more rapidly.
How long does it take for that? So you cut the roots off.
It might take a week or 10 days, and you'll start to see them. But at this time of the year, if they aren't really coloring up, you know, that's kind of surprising, I guess. Because usually you'll have some colored fruit on them.
So I have some on mine. They're in the middle, and the chickens have been finding them.
Oh.
Yeah, so they are ripening up. So I go out and I cut that off. A week to 10 days, I should start seeing the rest
of
them take
off. That's correct. And just turn the water off. Don't irrigate them anymore because it really isn't necessary. That drought stress will do an awful lot. The fruit are mostly sized anyway. The ones that are really small will never produce anything anyway. So get those plants started and quit coddling them. Quit, you know, giving them the life of Riley. Just treat abuse. Abuse is the key right now.
Now, unlike Will Pitkin, who would save his tomato hornworms, if you find any on your plants, bring them to my house because I will feed them to my
chickens.
Well,
I suspect Will did the same.
Probably fed them to his chickens.
Yeah, because the chickens, if they didn't find them already in his garden, which they may have if they had free run, like Will usually did, they kind of had a free run of the farm, so to speak. They probably were finding them in the garden, and so his numbers couldn't have been that great anyway if you're running chickens because they're pretty good at finding them. So and like you say, pick them and throw them in there. If you had grasshopper problems, the chickens like those too. So there's a lot of benefits to having the chickens running around.
Well, we have only about 7 or 8 minutes left in the program. Call us with your toll-free question or comment at 1-800-826-1495. Go to the UPR Facebook page and post your comment there, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So what other ripening issues could be going on at this point, and would you use the same methods?
Well, we've been picking, I think the melon crop this year has been probably one of our best. Watermelon, not so much, because watermelons seem to not like the excess heat that we had this year. And so we had some problems with vine collapse, and many of our commercial farmers complained of that too, that their watermelons would get up to a certain size and then the vine would die. And so then you had these less than full-sized fruits that are kind of sitting out in the sun baking and you know, didn't really get as sweet as they would like. But if they kept their vines healthy, you know, the melon crop was just phenomenal. I brought some honeydews the other day to a party that we went to, and people saw, oh, there's melons there, honeydews, and oh, they're from Dan, oh, this should be good, and they started biting into them, and a couple people actually said they thought they were too sweet.
Is that possible?
Well, I think that I thought they were too sweet.
Okay.
Not that I don't like the sugar component to it, but these things were, I mean, I've not probably recorded values. We measured the Brix reading in them, and we had Brixes of 19, which is extraordinarily high when the melons that you buy in the grocery store have usually a Brix value of about 10. So they were like twice that. You just couldn't eat quite as many of them because you were kind of going, man,
so
that's a lot of sugar. But I looked at it, it's natural sugar, so it can't hurt me.
and it comes with, I mean, it's not just straight sugar. It comes with the things that help process it.
That's right. So the cantaloupes and the honeydews and the cassabas that we've had this year and some of the French Chantenay melons and some of the watermelons that the vines stayed good on were, you know, exceptionally flavorful this year. And I think, you know, a lot of that heat that we had, the warm nights in particular, it's helpful. But they weren't excessively hot nights, you know. So some places in the state, the night temperature can be too high, and then the plant in its respiration, you know, the maintenance process of kind of self-feeding on it to get through the evening, you know, they burn off some of those sugars. But up here, we had just cool enough nights, hot enough days that those sugars could really build up in the fruit. And I was very, very pleased with the quality that we had, as well as the people that I brought melons this year.
So it was hot enough that I swear it was like 3 months in a row I didn't sleep with any covers on.
Yeah.
But it in Cache Valley anyway, the temperatures always dip into the high 50s, low 60s.
Yeah, and that's a good temperature for fruits that are trying to accumulate sugars, because, you know, the sugars are made during the warmth of the day, and then at night when the plant respires and kind of self feeds on those sugars to maintain cell structure over the evening, they don't burn them off so fast. So they're steadily accumulating, and that's why they were just really, really good. And so, you know, so we didn't have much ripening issues with that. Peppers, the one problem that we did see a lot of with peppers was sunburn this year. And so if you've had a pepper crop and you had a little kind of dried up spot on the side of it, you know, in the home garden, that's not such a big issue because you just cut around it and use it. But that was kind of a big problem this year because of, you know, this extra heat that we had. And so we got more of those kind of disorders showing up.
Is this where a floating row cover comes
in
handy?
Well, a little shade can help you in some of those crops. But, you know, the plants tend to produce enough fruit anyway that not all of them are going to be affected. And as I said, for the home garden, you know, a little bit of blemish on them isn't such a serious issue. The commercial farmers were kind of distraught about it this year because, you know, a lot of the fruit they were leaving to the side and not being able to market because they had a blemish on them that the market won't accept.
Because people look at it and they think, oh, there's something wrong with
it. Why should I pay for something that's something wrong, even though out of my own garden I'd eat it?
I was thinking of melons that are ripening right now, so they're probably not going to be quite as sweet.
Well, you know, we've had enough warm weather up till now, so, you know, a lot of those sugars accumulate, you know, throughout the ripening process. So, I mean, we had some cantaloupe yesterday out of the field trial that we had, and the flavor was still good, even though it's cooled off a bit. And, you know, naturally, as you move toward late September, the quality tends to deteriorate some, just simply because your days aren't warm enough and your nights are cooler than they have been. So that just, you know, the August, early September is probably the best time for melons anyway.
Okay, you have 50 seconds. Last word of advice.
Start thinking about, you know, if you've got stuff that you want to start for next year, you know, and you got some open spaces in the garden, you know, get some ground worked up and start seeding some spinach and things like that, which can overwinter. So some of those overwintering ones, they'll get established here. By the time October comes around, they're going to kind of slow up. Put some cover over top of them, leave them out there, and then come March, you're going to have some really nice spinach if you don't grow in a high tunnel or build a high tunnel this fall and have winter spinach all year.
Well, we have a call for you, and we'll have you take it off the air. So
okay, we'll do that.
Dan, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, and he's been our guest. So. And I forgot to completely ask you about why horticulture. So, okay, I'll have to do that for next month. So thank you for listening to The Zesty Garden.
Topping trees is bad for the look and health of your trees and landscape. Plus, it increases maintenance and the risk of tree failure. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Topping is the removal of large branches and trunks from the top of the tree. This severe pruning stimulates the growth of many weakly attached branches right beneath the cut. As these grow in size, they will need additional pruning. If left intact, they weaken the tree's overall structure, making it a potential hazard. So how do you bring a large tree down in size? First, decide if you need to. Trees are designed to support normal size and growth. If necessary, hire a certified arborist. Qualified arborists will use a reduction cut, also called drop crotching or thinning to a lateral, to reduce the height of the tree. Longer branches are cut back to a side branch that is at least one-third the diameter of the limb being removed. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.